Don't frighten us by telling us the facts. 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 We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on January 7th, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to talk again about Trump's Voter Suppression Commission, and then Rachel joins me to talk about oil drilling in Anwar and offshore. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line this week is Nate. Nate, welcome back and Happy New Year.
Thanks, Bill.
So this first segment, you and I are going to be talking about the Voter Suppression or Voter Rights Commission, so-called, of the Trump administration again. This is something that you had done a segment on previously here on the show. What's the big new development on that front?
Right. Well, the Voter Suppression or Voter Fraud Commission, however you want to call it, has been canceled. Trump pulled the plug on it, and basically some aspects of it, I guess, may be going to Department of Homeland Security. It's kind of unclear how much of what exactly is going to be happening on that front, so I don't think the danger has really fully gone away. But it is interesting that basically Trump just got rid of it, and I guess the cause of that is the Maine Secretary of State, Matthew Dunlap, had sued the commission a bunch of times. He was a member of the commission, but they're basically not sharing the correct documents with him and trying to behave as secretly as possible. And so he was he's launched some lawsuits, and the White House issued a statement, said they canceled it, quote, rather than engage in endless legal battles at the taxpayer expense. And I think we talked about previously how they were explicitly saying, like, one of this Heritage Foundation guy was very mad that Democrats and, quote, moderate or no, mainstream Republicans would be allowed on the commission. So, I mean, they were clearly trying to be as secretive as possible from the very start.
So the Maine lawsuit seems to have been pretty critical in this. I guess that guy was criticized a little bit initially for joining the commission, but then what, used it as kind of an inside role as like a mole to get
right.
dirt on it.
Yeah, and he and three other Democrats on the 11-member commission were basically frozen out of the deliberations, and so yeah, basically it seems like they were trying to operate in the shadows, and once it was clear that that wouldn't be possible, basically they were like, all right, we're just gonna give this up and try to do it behind the scenes in Department of Homeland Security.
What are some of the other angles that we need to be thinking about on this story? It's obviously continuing to develop over the past couple of weeks, but where have things gone since we last talked about this on the show? Where are things potentially heading?
Right. Well, I think it's important that we mention another issue that we talked about last time, which is a lot of this is centered in New Hampshire. And of course, we all remember the Stephen Miller quote where he's talking about people being bussed up the border from Massachusetts to swing the election for both Hillary in New Hampshire and also for Maggie Hassan, who won a close race there. I think it was about 730 or so votes. So they're really fixated on, oh, we lost a Senate seat because of the people voting. And recently, the New Hampshire legislature and New Hampshire Senate passed a voting residency requirement bill, along party lines, basically, and require you to have a New Hampshire driver's license, register your car there. And it's been pointed out that this would largely impact college students and could potentially be viewed as a poll tax, in the sense that, you know, driver's license costs money, you need to register, you've got the plate fees, municipal fees. So it could add up to a couple hundred dollars if you're just trying to vote, if you're going to school there or something. So that, I mean, it's unclear the constitutionality of that, whether that'll get struck down. But so, and actually, I guess Governor Sununu, Republican, but he's said that he opposes it. And so he may veto it. But yeah, this HB 372. So that's a little up in the air at that point. But that it is sort of part of the fixation that the Republicans have had in terms of making it as difficult as possible for students to vote, and of course, all sorts of other types of people to vote. And so, but this is something that could be replicated in a bunch of other states, I imagine, given the sort of Republican penchant to sort of pioneer these types of initiatives on the state level.
Sure. And that actually brings us to a good point. Rachel's going to be on in the next segment, but she was mentioning to us off air that she wanted to highlight that the state of Idaho very enthusiastically cooperated with this voter fraud, quote unquote, commission or voter suppression commission, providing all the data that was requested and that sort of thing, right? And then, you know, they actually were one of the states that was participating in efforts before the federal thing under Trump. Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State in Kansas, is like often very like closely linked with this in the news. You know, this is kind of one of his babies at the federal level. And, you know, Kansas, even before his tenure, was very active in what was, I guess, euphemistically called the Interstate Voter Registration Cross-Check Program, which goes back to 2005. But like in around 2014 or so, it was like really amped up. And Kobach was like one of the people that was really pushing that, trying to get like states to work together to make sure that people weren't like registered in multiple states and voting in different places and that sort of thing, which doesn't really happen. There was a statistic I saw something about like the algorithm, the software that was like helping to scrub the voter file found like 7 million potential matches for double registered or whatever. And of course it turns out, as these computerized things often do, oh, you got the wrong person, or you know, you mismatched the names slightly, you know, got the wrong middle name, or you left out a junior or senior distinction or something like that. And so they ended up, you know, maybe three or so people actually faced any sort of legal action because of allegedly being, you know, misregistered or something like that. And Idaho was one of the states that was cooperating back in 2014 before this Trump executive order and Trump commission. And, you know, I kind of compared it to like, this is the Secretary of State equivalent at the state government level of selling arms to other countries, is that you, when you need to patch a hole in the Kansas budget, as we've talked about before, why not encourage them to, you know, encourage other states to get your software for scrubbing their voter files. And the consequences of this, of course, are things like, you know, 1.5 million people being thrown off the Ohio voter rolls right before the 2016 election, and then that getting tied up in the courts. Similar situation in North Carolina with a smaller number of voters, but still significant. This kind of thing keeps on playing out in all these different states where there's really heavy, overwhelming Republican control of the state government, unlike in, say, New Hampshire. These Kansas, Idaho type models get exported to these critical swing states where there's Republican control of state government, and it has pretty severe consequences for the electoral outcomes. I think we're going to definitely, as Nate said, this is not going away anytime soon. We're going to have to keep an eye on what the Department of Homeland Security role in this is, because as other news stories have talked about, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency has which is in under the Homeland Security, and they may be involved with this, according to some of the, you know, rumors and statements surrounding this change in the Trump Voter Commission. ICE has a history of literally arresting or detaining and deporting the wrong people. Like based on a name error or something like that. Like,
right,
you know, getting, they meant to go get senior and they accidentally picked up junior, who's actually a U.S. citizen. You know, especially apparently there's a very high risk for naturalized citizens. Like, if ICE doesn't realize, because their database isn't, you know, perfectly synced up or whatever, if they don't realize that somebody had gotten their citizenship at some point, you know, through the appropriate legal channels, you know, and they may not have even been undocumented to begin with. They might have been on some sort of temporary residency thing or asylum status. If they got their citizenship given to them and ICE doesn't know that, they have been known to arrest those people and try to deport them out of the country. And so if that's the direction we're headed with this voter roll stuff, we are in very deep trouble as well, even if this commission itself is being dissolved for now.
Yeah, and I mean, just when you also look at all the various roundups that ICE has been doing, sort of empowered by Trump, I think the total numbers that were deported were, I think, actually less than Obama's last year. It seems like deportations are down, but immigration arrests are up compared to the last year of the Obama presidency, or at least the fiscal year.
Which is, I mean, sort of probably reflective of the fact that a lot of people make a huge amount of revenue off of the detentions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, that's the perfect scenario, right? Is you arrest these people, but you don't actually deport them, because then you can, somebody can be making money off of that at the, you know, whether it's the county jail that's contracted out space to ICE, like there's a lot of that in New England, or the for-profit federal detention centers all over the country. There's a lot of people making a ton of money off of these arrests and detentions, and that money goes away if you're actually deporting the people. So they've found somehow a way to make this even worse.
They're commodifying it. Yeah, and it also seems like fewer people are trying to cross the U.S. border illegally just compared to last year. So that's part of it, because I guess they'll deport you right away if you're near the border, I guess. But they don't have the detention facilities set up there yet. So
other angles that we need to talk about on this voter commission story?
I think it's pretty important to emphasize that while this commission, you know, didn't exactly accomplish a lot, it sort of put to the for the desire and sort of continuing like efforts of these various Republicans to, you know, really push forward their agenda of making sure it's as difficult as possible to vote. I just want to read a quote from one of the commission members, J. Christian Adams, who is big into this. He leads an organization whose work includes a report titled Alien Invasion 2, which details the presence of non-citizens on the voter rolls in Virginia. I'm just reading from a Washington Post article on the subject, but basically said after the Election Integrity Commission was canceled, foes of election integrity lost their seats at the table, he said. Now the important work of improving the integrity of the election process will be done by people who believe in election integrity, not by those who seek to preserve vulnerabilities in the system. Before long, they realize that advocates of election integrity have more stamina, support, and perseverance than they realize. And I do think he's not just saying that. I think they will continue and work at the state level all across the country to, you know, continue to make it as difficult as possible to vote, you know, whether that's closing early voting or just all sorts of the different types of rollbacks they've done, making it more difficult to get an ID or what kinds of IDs you can use. I think there are some states where you can't use a student ID, but you can use a gun license. So things like that. And so I think the important thing there is to also continue to focus on this and continue to fight against it and work to make sure voting is, you know, as simple as possible and not, you know, something where you have to go re-register your car and get a new driver's license and pay hundreds of dollars and things like that that they're already trying to do. So.
And I think I agree that, you know, that the quote that you were reading there, sure, some of it's like just bloviating or whatever. But at some level, I mean, he's absolutely capturing the sort of MO that the conservative movement has used since what, like the 1950s, where it's like, we're just going to be very patient and take our losses, you know, as temporary and just continue to bide our time until we've amassed more power and can follow through on this, right? I mean, that's sort of their strategy with the courts, which has completely worked. You know, it took them forever. They decided that the courts were this liberal faction that they had no control over. So they just very carefully emphasized for decades to their voters and their elected officials about the importance of taking a hard line on the judicial appointments. And now they control the judiciary pretty much. So I think you're right that this pattern is going to persist with this voter stuff. I mean, most of it is like, this is just reboots of, you know, Jim Crow era voter suppression stuff, and now exported to northern states as well, and non-southern states all over the country. Like, this is the pattern that they keep following, and they renovate it and they update it and whatever. But this is fundamentally the same thing. It's just the newest form of it. And they're going to continue to do that because it's worked out very well for them. And when you have this sort of collapsing, shrinking core base that, you know, you're in a position where your party can't leave them behind because the jump to a new coalition would be so monumentally huge of a gap to leap across that you would lose too many voters without gaining enough quickly enough to maintain your sort of structural integrity as a political party. Then you find yourself doubling down on that shrinking core base instead, because you know you can't win anybody else when you're appealing to them. So that means you have to ensure that those are the only people voting to the extent practicable. You've got to prevent the non-white people from voting and anybody that's not a conservative or likely to vote conservative. Anything you can do to prevent, you know, students, young people, older people that don't agree with you from, you know, anything like that.
Minorities,
the poor, anybody you can think of where you're like, well, it would be inconvenient for us to have these people voting. You figure out a way to keep them from voting, and then, you know, combine this with other things like gerrymandering and stuff like that. And then your party can be presiding over a dying star and just say, well, we've shut out everyone else, so this will keep us going for a while. And it, you know, that's it. Like I said, it goes back to the Jim Crow model. It's also very similar to other, you know, models of other countries where they have like a democracy on paper, but only some people get to participate in it, and the rest of the population is excluded. And they say, look at our democratic institutions, but of course, it's not really a true representative democracy by any stretch of the imagination. But you know, it goes back to that point that they have more stamina, and they're going to continue to outlast. Because I do think there will be a lot of people who like. Every time this, you know, there's some victory on the voting rights issues, they like then say, oh, good, that's taken care of, and then go move on to something else.
Yeah, you can't ignore it and pretend that the issue is just going to go away because the Republicans definitely aren't.
Something that I've been hearing people talking about a lot, I think, in the last couple of months, but not maybe as much as I would have hoped, is are we going to make voting rights stuff an actual sort of electoral focus of the platform, you know, that candidates are running on going forward if they're, you know, running against the Republicans, like the Democratic Party, I guess, if we're being specific, like in 2018 and 2020, are they going to make that a big focus? And I'm not seeing it so far. Like there's lip service to it, but it doesn't seem like it's a huge focus on the horizon, and like we're so screwed without it. Like if we, and not just the Democrats, but like the country is screwed if we don't get a voting rights restored and in some sort of a really serious, permanent, comprehensive way. I don't know. It's something to think about, I guess. And it goes to another like more general problem, kind of with the consulting class of the Democratic Party, I think. And this isn't just to do with voting rights, but they put out they have these surveys that are like, what's the most important issue for Americans or American voters? And, you know, it'll be something like the economy or healthcare or whatever. And like sometimes in the polls, they let people choose multiple answers, but usually you're just allowed to choose one answer. So then like the quote unquote top three issues will be something like, you know, the economy, the healthcare, jobs, or something like that. And that's just like, those are the three biggest plurality groups of the respondents. And then they'll tell their candidates, the consultants or whatever, will say like, oh, like just focus on that. Don't talk about any of this other stuff. Voters don't care about it. but in some cases, you know, it might not be like the top issue, but it's still important to people. It might even be everyone's second issue for all we know. You know, but you're not asking that question. And then, you know, you could even have broader agreement. I mean, that's hugely an environmental issue. Like, there's overwhelming agreement from voters on environmental issues. Like, they agree with the Democratic positions most of the time, like, you know, 60-something, 70% of the country usually agreeing with, like, yeah, I think we should have clean air and clean water for my kids. Like, that's not a controversial position. It's not ranked among the top three responses for what is your top issue, your number one issue. But everyone agrees with it, and if you ran more emphasis on it, you might actually succeed. I think there's a similar issue with voting rights, which is, like, there's obviously a large section of the population that's, like, very cranky on voting rights, and they don't believe that other people should be allowed to vote, and they're pretty open about that. But I don't think that's a majority. I think that's not even close to a majority. I think most people actually would agree that making it easier to vote is good, and they want that. Voting rights is good, and they want that. Like, I think that the majority of the population actually does agree on that, and it's troubling to not, for, you know, both political strategic reasons and, like, just overall strategic reasons of needing to survive, that the Dems aren't pushing that particularly.
Yeah, well, obviously the consultant class is kind of an anchor around the neck of the Democratic Party. That's been pretty clear for a while. I do think that it seems like there was some shift towards having this as an actual issue, or at least increased awareness that this is an issue, as opposed to, you know, maybe a decade ago where people were struggling to pronounce gerrymander and, you know, not really taking seriously this type of thing, or maybe conceding to Republicans on, like, voter ID, things like that. And I guess now it's at least being talked about, but the focus needs to be on it. And I think it's probably, hopefully you'll see at least some people talking about it as a election issue, because it did seem like a lot of states were moving to open up voting in terms of, like, early voting, voting by mail, like, I guess, in Oregon. And but it seems like there's been a retrenchment and sort of a pullback now that the Republicans have been controlling a lot of these state legislatures since 2010. And they're making it as difficult as possible. And they've been doing that for a while now. So there needs to be a sort of a reaction to that, and getting people in office and then, you know, making it easier to vote, or just not a massive burden where you have to go re-register your car and things like that.
And if you go to arsenalfordemocracy.com and check back through some of the episodes, I don't remember off the top of my head the exact number, but I believe we did do an episode that was, the whole hour was devoted to voting reforms that could be done, that the Democrats should be pushing for, that would make it easier to vote and get involved with the democratic process. There's a whole bunch of bills in Congress that have been proposed of various ideas, you know, weekend voting, a voting holiday, mandatory voting, vote by mail, automatic voter registration, no excuse absentee voting, all kinds of things. Some of them, you know, different alternatives to the same thing. Some of them compatible with each other. Like, there's a whole list of different ideas that we could be pushing. And like you said, it seems like there's been this retrenchment where they're not really pushing it that heavily. Like, there's not that much discussion of, you know, hey, we need to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act, especially the parts that got, you know, fix the parts that got struck down by the Supreme Court a number of years back. You know, that doesn't seem to be on the table particularly. The only person who really seems to push it a lot is the governor of Oregon, Kate Brown, just because she was the Secretary of State in Oregon, and they had already had a lot of voting reforms before she took over that job. But when she had that job, she also implemented, and then in the governor's office, continued to implement some of the newer reforms that they had, like automatic voter registration on top of the vote by mail stuff. And so that's something that she pushes, but that's pretty unusual for a lot of these people to be advocating for this issue. Well, Nate, thank you so much for joining us this week to talk about the latest news on the Voter Fraud, Voter Suppression Commission.
Thanks, Bill.
All right. Arsenal for Democracy will be back in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. Please stick around. In just a moment, Rachel will be on. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey, here in Massachusetts. On the line from Idaho, joining us as usual is Rachel. Hello, Rachel. Welcome back and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too as well, Bill.
All right. So on that note of a Happy New Year, let's start off with the bad news from this new year, specifically on the issue of oil drilling. We're going to be talking a little bit later in the segment about offshore oil drilling because there was a big announcement in the new year about that. But let's close out 2017 properly by talking about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge provision that was, I guess what, snuck into the tax reform bill, as we all know, the famous tax reforms of Arctic oil drilling. Walk us through that a little bit, Rachel.
So yeah, as you said, it was kind of snuck in there. I know it was kind of a concession to Lisa Murkowski, who is very bullish on oil drilling in Alaska and in ANWR in particular, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, commonly known as ANWR. So I know she kind of rallied support around it by hearkening back to the memory of the late Senator Ted Stevens, who is also very big on ANWR drilling. And so to basically win her vote, they kind of conceded and are proposing to open up this ANWR refuge to oil drilling. And I think it's about 1.5 million acres in what is known as the Section 1002 area, which is like the coastal area north in northern Alaska. So it's long been a point of contention. I think people have been trying to open it up for drilling since the Reagan administration. It's kind of been batted back and forth for over the decades. I know Bush tried to open it up. Obama was obviously against it. Clinton was against it. So it's just been kind of a political football for all these years. And then finally, it seems like it's going to be opened up. But however, I'm sure there'll be a huge legal fight amongst like conservation groups and also a legislative fight if after the 2018 elections, Democrats can kind of win more seats in the House and Senate and maybe kind of start to legislatively fight back against this and dismantle some of these provisions in the tax bill.
In addition to conservation groups, I think we can expect, if they have not already filed, lawsuits from various indigenous organizations and corporations, because in the lower 48, there have been some recent lawsuits in a number of different states against the Interior Department for various drilling proposals on protected lands and things like that. And those are usually one of the indigenous nations will file the suit in Alaska. The Alaskan peoples, Alaska natives, often are organized as, well, I don't know exactly how you describe it, but rather than the standard nation government model in the lower 48, they have a slightly different model in many cases, not all, where they're organized as like a corporation, a specialized corporation that is supposed to act on behalf of the Alaska Native peoples in various affairs, because a lot of the stuff does relate very closely to resources and land and things like that. And so it's easier for them, I think, to be represented on that particular footing of a corporation. It's slightly different, I think, than some of the sovereignty issues that come with being like a tribal government. But again, I think I'm not an expert by any means on this. I just have some familiarity with bits and pieces of it. So I think we can expect some of that in Alaska from some of those entities, in addition to the conservation groups. But I mean, it's going to be an absolute disaster if drilling actually takes place in additional areas of ANWR. Because I think there's a couple areas that already were, you know, grandfathered in from before that was off limits. And it's just catastrophic from even one site where there's an oil well. The heat blooms associated with those drilling projects are just tremendous. They, you know, especially in the permafrost, everything's kind of unstable. Everything's already starting to warm up a lot from global warming and the permafrost destabilizing that way. You add on top of it these industrial facilities for oil drilling, even on a small scale. That's just, you know, very much contributing to that problem. Also, there were, you know, trucks that would come in like the 1980s or whenever, maybe even the 70s, to set up these drilling sites, and then there would just be like tire treads across the permafrost for literally 10, 20, 30 years after, the last truck had gone over that spot. That's what it is, permafrost, right? There's a semi-permanent component to this where stuff just sort of lingers and doesn't go away. And I don't think that, unfortunately, I don't think that a lot of these lawsuits are going to be that successful from the indigenous peoples, especially in Alaska, because so far everyone seems pretty fine with ruling against them and ignoring their lawsuits when they're suing to say, hey, we need federal disaster relief to relocate our villages because the area that our traditional community had lived on is falling into the ocean from global warming, or the sea level is coming up. And it's really tragic, and they have not been treated very well in the long historical arc, but they have definitely not been treated well in the last decade or so on these specific issues. And I would be surprised, unfortunately, to see that changing in a positive direction. But of course, we'll keep an eye on it.
Yeah, and I think our collective memories are a little too short. I guess like 2010 was the Deepwater Horizon oil spill that lasted, how long did it last? 6 months, longer than that. And we're still seeing the effects today with the fishing operations there off the coast of Louisiana. And even farther back is the Exxon Valdez spill, which was the greatest spill of its time in 1989 in the Alaska area. So I think we just kind of forget how awful these oil spills are, how expensive they are, how ecologically damaging they are. So I think it's hard to get the public to remember this and to speak out against it, because there will be a public opinion period, but I don't know if we'll be able to mobilize people to kind of turn the tide of public opinion against developing in the Anwar area. So it remains to be seen, I guess.
To your point about Deepwater Horizon, which we're going to come back to a few more times in this segment, in the last week or so, the Interior Department rescinded the Obama-era regulations, some of which came in at the end, some of which were associated with Deepwater Horizon, for things like fracking regulations on federal and tribal lands, as well as the specific offshore drilling safety regulations put into place in response to Deepwater Horizon. Those have been repealed by the Interior Department just in the last week or so. That's nuts, to your point, right?
Yeah, it's a signal to the oil and gas companies that this is a very friendly administration, and they're going to knock out all these environmental protections and all these safety protections that are meant to prevent these tragedies from happening in the first place. And we're just knocking down all the obstacles and opening the way to creating a new disaster that could be even worse than Deepwater Horizon or Exxon Valdez in the future. So it's kind of mind-boggling to think how we're just, if it had Obama's name on it, it must be struck down, no matter how good the executive order was and how much it tried to protect the environment and the workers that are working on these oil rigs.
All right. Anything else we need to know about Anwar before we talk about offshore drilling more broadly?
It's super important for caribou, polar bears, brown bears, black bears, lynx, moose, arctic fox, walruses, and ring seals, and migratory birds. So I think there's a lot of unique animal species, especially the caribou. There's the porcupine caribou that are sacred to tribes in the area. So I think we just need to be cognizant of the damage that can be done and the animal species that could be lost due to this offshore drilling.
Yeah, not much of a wildlife refuge if you throw out the refuge part whenever it becomes inconvenient.
Yeah, then the wildlife kind of tend to go away as well. So, yeah.
All right, let's talk about now the even bigger and badder news, the DPP, the draft proposed program from Interior Department on 47 potential lease sales offshore. There are 25 of 26 planning areas that the federal government designates for offshore regions for potential things like drilling. 25 out of the 26 are are under consideration for these 47 potential lease sales. You can go to the Interior Department website, doi.gov, if you want to put in a public comment against this proposal, or for, I guess. I don't know why you're listening to the show, though, if you're for it. But this would be 19 sales off the coast of Alaska, so basically much larger than just Anwar. There's this bigger picture on Alaska. 7 in the Pacific region, so that would be primarily California, basically, but I guess potentially also like Oregon and Washington. 12 in the Gulf of Mexico, so we're talking like Louisiana, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi. And 9 in the Atlantic region, and they say very proudly that this is the largest number of lease sales ever proposed for the National OCS Program's 5-year lease schedule. Now, I'm not going to get too much into, like, technicality stuff on leases, because we talked a lot about that in our episode on the need for reforming the oil drilling leasing program in the United States. There's many reforms needed there in general, and that's separate even from the issue of potentially buying and nationalizing the oil and gas industry, which we've talked about on that episode. But this is very alarming, these proposals. The Atlantic region I want to touch on a little bit, because this is even bigger than has ever been proposed before, I think, or at least certainly in the last several decades. This goes all the way up to New England, so not just as far as Delaware or New Jersey, but all the way up, you know, to the coast of Maine and everything. And these are probably, if I'm guessing, these are probably sites that, like, could be used for offshore wind production instead of offshore oil. But no, they want to go for the offshore oil production. I do want to give great credit to the governor of Delaware, John Carney. We're going to be talking in a moment about the 2010 offshore proposal for drilling. And when he was running for Congress in 2010, he was not in the House yet, but he was running for Congress. He came out very strongly against that proposal, as did Senator Chris Coons, who was running for Senate at the time. Not such a great statement from Tom Carper at the time, unfortunately. John Carney has been very consistent, and he spoke out again immediately in opposition to this proposal for drilling off the coast of Delaware, or, you know, technically it would probably be off the coast of Virginia, because that's where some of the potential oil fields are. But in the geography is such that off the coast of Virginia in that part means off the coast of Delaware, effectively. Also, interestingly, like, no statement so far from the Republican governor of Massachusetts, but vehement opposition from the governor of Florida, who is a Republican, Rick Scott. And his basis for that is opposing this on the grounds of the Deepwater Horizon disaster, which I think is a reasonable proposal for him to point toward. And interesting that he's taking that specific position on the heels of this rollback of the Deepwater Horizon related protections on offshore oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. The other thing that I want to note about this is that this is eerily similar to, in many respects, the very, for lack of a better term, boneheaded move that the Obama administration made in March of 2010. That is what I was referring to by the 2010 proposal that was sort of floated casually in the 2010 State of the Union address, and then suddenly one day was announced from the Interior Department and President Obama that all of a sudden he was going to open offshore drilling all over the country, potentially. I remember that was one of the times that I've been the absolute angriest with the Obama administration, and I think a lot of people were as well. And, you know, they eventually pulled the plug on it and it instead went in the other direction of instituting these new regulations. But it's very important to remember the timing of that, which is that that announcement, kind of more or less out of the blue, was made in March of 2010, right? And April 20th, like about a month later, there was the blowout that happened on Deepwater Horizon. So if it were not for Deepwater Horizon exploding at exactly the time that it did, it is very probable that the Obama administration would not have walked back from this very abrupt proposal to open drilling all over the United States offshore areas, particularly focused on the Gulf of Mexico at the time, Alaska, and the Atlantic coast up as far as and including Delaware, but then New Jersey and North to New England was not included in that proposal at that time. But, you know, if you look side by side at the New York Times articles of January 2018 and March 2010, we're looking at very similar articles here. You know, and a lot of those, you know, couched in a lot of these quotes about making hard choices regarding energy independence, blah, blah, blah. Whereas, of course, the Trump administration is just straight up making a two-pronged argument of energy dominance. That's their phrase that they're using. We don't want just energy independence. We want energy dominance. And that there's too much revenue out there to leave on the table or under the water, as the case may be, which that sort of speaks again to that big problem of why we probably need to look seriously at, as outlined in the detailed proposal on arsenalfordemocracy.com in the previous radio episode that you can listen to. We have a PDF with all the details and everything. But the reason that the U.S. government is going to have to end up buying out most of the oil and gas industry and acquiring that through a combination of buyouts and Fifth Amendment, public domain, things like that, is that these companies, while they're claiming, oh, it's not that profitable, it might take 10 or 15 years to come online, like, these companies, if given the opportunity, are going to continue to drill this stuff well past our actual climatic threshold that we can possibly accept this. I mean, it would be especially bad to have new oil drilling sites coming online 10 or 15 years from now when we need to be going in the complete opposite direction. This notion that we can't just afford to leave these revenues, these hypothetical potential revenues, under the, you know, ocean floor, we can't just leave that there. That is the impetus that if you do not, I mean, it's a potential impetus if you've bought out the industry as well and have a state-owned oil industry. But if you buy it out with, if you don't buy it out with the intention of shutting it down, these private companies are going to continue to try to get that revenue as much as possible. And of course, then, you know, kick some of it, a very small fraction of it, toward the federal government in the form of royalties. So that's sort of where we are on this. I'm very frustrated and angry with this, you know, especially introducing these new areas to offshore oil drilling for the first time since the moratorium in the late 1980s under Ronald Reagan. But again, that probably wouldn't be on the table, or at least like sort of seen as a common sense proposal in many circles, if it had not been sort of put back on the table abruptly by the Obama administration voluntarily out of nowhere when they had a Democratic Congress. There was no reason to do that. They put it back on the table. That gets people saying, viewing that again as a legitimate option to be doing this offshore drilling that is just simply not a legitimate option for climatic reasons. Also, I was looking at some old blog posts at the time where I was very upset about this in 2010. And like the statistic that I used at the time, which I've forgotten about, but I used to cite it a lot, was that there was a UMass study that said that home weatherization for like energy efficiency and heating efficiency and things like that creates more jobs per dollar than oil drilling. So it's not even creating jobs. Like, the whole thing is garbage and it's in the wrong direction and it's terrible. And for some reason, Obama like legitimized this before Trump got into office.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out that 61% of Americans support natural resource and energy conservation over production of new fossil fuel reserves. So we Americans as a country are seeing the writing on the wall. We see the long term effects of fossil fuel extraction. We want to develop a renewable energy infrastructure and an industry that is already there. I think there's more people working in the solar in energy industry than there are coal miners. So I think we need to look away from fossil fuel extraction, look to the future, which is solar, which is wind. Like you said, wind energy infrastructure would create more jobs, more revenue than offshore drilling in the Atlantic. It doesn't make sense. It's really perplexing. And I think we can get a bipartisan push against it, because if you read some of these articles and some of the people that are opposing it, it's kind of like a rogues gallery. Like you said, Governor Rick Scott, Marco Rubio, Daryl Issa, like some of the worst of the worst. And even they're speaking out against this. So I think we can definitely push the narrative away from this and towards renewable energy. And I think the American public is already in that mindset. We just need to get the legislature set up and started as soon as possible.
I'm glad that you cited that poll, because you were not on the last segment, but it dovetails perfectly with a discussion that Nate and I were having about these issues where the polling actually shows broad agreement with the more liberal or lefty position on an issue. Like pretty broad agreement in the public, but for some reason it's not considered a a high enough priority issue to actually like heavily focus on during a campaign. Although, as I keep on trying to reiterate, like, most people don't want their kids drinking down like benzene fluids from fracking wells and like, you know, inhaling oil and coal production stuff, like whatever it is, you know, or the oil itself in their food and water supplies in the Gulf of Mexico. Like, parents don't want that. Like, they might not remember to say it as their top issue when polled on the phone about what your top, your number one issue is, but they pretty much agree on that by a wide margin, and yet we don't talk about it. And this is something where the Democrats could run on this of like, hey, we're going to stop this nonsense with the new drilling sites and protect our natural resources. That's what the public wants, but they're not going to do that as far as I can tell. And as has been the case on many of these issues, they lack the credibility to run on those because of very recently endorsing the same exact position as the Republicans. Which, speaking of Tom Carper, when he was on this show in 2012, when he was running for re-election in 2012, he laughed very hard and irately and was disputing me for several minutes when I said that some members of the public feel that there's not enough difference between the two parties. And I was talking about his role at the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, in positioning the Democratic Party, especially in the 90s. But like, when you put these things side by side, and that's an example of like, he kind of cautiously waffled on that issue at the time in 2010, instead of taking a strong stand against it immediately. Like, this is what I'm saying, right? Like, I'm not saying that the two parties are the same. I'm saying that on a lot of specific issues, they do stupid positioning on these things and bring up stuff out of nowhere that then the Republicans can say, look, we're in agreement on that. And the voting public can look at that and go, yeah, they are in agreement on that. And then you don't have any more credibility on that. And this was a major, the energy strategy in general from Barack Obama was pretty terrible, especially in the first term. We didn't get a climate bill. We didn't get the clean power plan stuff until later, I think in the second term. You know, they didn't pass a bill regulating power plants in the first term. But like the worst thing going back to the 2008 campaign before he even took office was this insistence on a quote unquote all of the above strategy, which included things like North Dakota shale oil drilling and natural gas production in the Marcellus shale fields in the Northeast in the U.S., as well as like more mountaintop removal mining and coal and things like that. And, with the promise of clean coal, carbon sequestration, the technologies do not exist for that. Certainly not anywhere near cost effectiveness, but for some reason mention that as, oh, it's going to take an all of the above strategy for energy independence. No, it doesn't take an all of the above strategy. Sure, you have to piece together a bunch of different renewable things to get to meet your energy needs, but this all of the above thing is total bunk because that's not true. And the goal isn't energy independence, including fossil fuels. It's energy independence from fossil fuels, because this stuff is killing our population and killing our planetary civilizational future on a very short-term basis. For some reason, that didn't seem to occur to the Obama campaign in 2008, and that continued into 2010. And that was the one silver lining of Deepwater Horizon exploding, was that it actually put a stop to some of this and finally started to pivot things to some degree on the energy policy, although the rest of 2010 was also a huge garbage write-off on the environmental and energy stuff. As you can tell, I am still extremely bitter about a lot of the stuff that went down in 2010 on this specific issue of climate and energy. Rachel, any closing thoughts on any of these points about drilling?
Well, I think if we do message properly and do remind people that we don't want our children drinking benzene water or breathing in coal dust or what have you, I think we can definitely push the Democrats left on this and win on a strong message of conservation, because the people want this. And I think there's just been really poor messaging. I know conservation isn't everyone's number one topic, but it ties everything together. Racial justice, environment, because communities of color often get the brunt of these environmental disasters. So I think, if you have an area of concern, you can tie it into the environment and really push a strong message, united message about and win on that, basically.
I certainly hope so. All right. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for being on this week to talk about these unfortunate new developments.
Always a pleasure, no matter how dire the news is.
2018, here we come. First episode of the year. Oh, and I want to remind people as well before we sign off here, if you have topics that you think we haven't covered on the show in a while or you want us to cover for the first time, feel free to send us those. You can send them on to our email address, or it's very easy to reach us on Twitter or the Facebook page for the show, because we did a lot of big ideas, topics, and things like that over the year 2017, and sort of ran through our list of the big ideas that we really wanted to hit over the course of the year. Obviously, there's more things to talk about, but we don't want to necessarily be like talking about news of the week on the show. We want to be talking about those big ideas and the bigger picture things. It's fine if we want to jump off of something to talk about a bigger story. But if you have something that you think we should return to, go more in depth on, or that we haven't done so far, feel free to suggest that. Can't guarantee it'll make it onto the show, but we really want folks to get involved with suggesting things that they want to hear more about. And we really do appreciate all the listeners in 2017 who got really excited about some of the big ideas that we were floating and started evangelizing them to other people and sharing the show because of that. So that was really cool. We want to keep that up in 2018 as much as possible. That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFD Radio or email AFDradio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on arsenalfordemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.